All right, so thank you very much, Peter, because that kind of frees me from starting to apologize. Why am I introducing a topic which seemingly has nothing to do with the workshop? So in fact, we had some discussions last week and this week, partially with Peter, partially without Peter. So I will put them to the end. I will put the somewhat better established stuff in the beginning. All right. So, sorry. This is somehow a leftover from a talk that I gave recently. I thought I can as well start with that because this is kind of really all what you need as a basis to understand what I'm talking about. Okay. So we have the susceptibility of any medium, and in particular, of course, an atomic gas medium, just a two-level medium. We are interested in both the absorption and the dispersion, which we will usually display as just a real part and imaginary part of the susceptibility. So if you understand this curve, you should be perfectly set for the rest. Here again, sorry, I know you don't need that. Okay, so I will start with a very, very brief introduction to electromagnetically induced transparency, both in order to set the stage for the kind of quantum optical types of effects which we are talking about, but also because EIT actually, in fact, plays a direct role in this negative index stuff. And then I will show you how the negative refraction works. And for that, first we need the electromagnetically induced chirality. And then I will talk about the realization. And then in the outlook, I will try to see how that might go together with the cold atoms. Okay. This is what we usually have. Okay, so we have some vacuum and some glass, and we send some light in. And if the glass has an, for example, if our medium has an index that's larger than 1, then we get our beam refracted with an angle that is smaller than the incoming angle. And the whole thing is ruled by Snell's law. Goes with ratio of the ends, goes like the ratio of the sines of these two angles. Okay? So now we have the same setup, but with a negative refractive material. In this case, we have the same incoming beam, but now our n prime is minus 1. This minus 1 is actually of particular importance for all the community, and I only say very little why. If you want to know at some later point exactly why, I mean, I'm perfectly prepared to explain you anything on the blackboard. Anyway, so we have basically the same angle rule in this case as well. So since we have here this ratio of minus 1, so the angles also have to have a ratio of minus 1. So what happens is that this refraction goes to the other side of the normal. That's all. Okay. Also, Snell's law is still valid, so fortunately we don't have to re-understand everything. What is a little bit strange is that now the material becomes left-handed, so instead of EBK, we have EBK. Okay. Once you keep that in mind, nothing can go wrong anymore. This was first pioneered by Veselago already a long time ago. And I should say that Veselago is still alive and kicking in the field, or perhaps again kicking in the field. I think he was alive all the time. Pendry probably was the one person who most kind of forwarded the field about in the 90s and so on, and also was part of pioneering the first experiments to show a negative index, etc. This is how Scientific American sees negative index of refraction. So here we have a normal. I mean, this might be water. If you put the pencil into water, you see just this pencil slightly bent. If you put the pencil on the matter material, it looks like it comes out again on the other side. Okay. Unfortunately, we are not very likely to see something like that anytime soon. Okay. Well, perhaps. Okay, a few other effects. What is kind of important, especially if you want to do something theoretical, for normal refraction, we have a phase velocity which is, in for all practical purposes, somewhere of the order of magnitude of c. The group velocity usually is somewhat smaller than b, but it has the same direction. Whereas for the negative refraction, the group velocity can be, at least for n equals minus 1, is basically c or somewhere close to that, but the phase velocity changes sign. So this is basically the important point. Or instead, as we have seen before, the k vector changes sign. This is actually more important for all the kind of solid state or whatever later optical lattice. Yeah. Yes, but I think that would be pretty boring. I think you wouldn't get anything in or out. Actually, I also took that from the same Scientific American. They list a couple of effects, and some of the effects are that the Cherenkov radiation turns around if you have a negative index of refraction, and the Doppler effect turns around. So where you have blue shifted in a vacuum, you would have red shifted in an n-1. So I say applications. There's basically one important application that people have in mind, and this is the so-called superlens, which was already mentioned by Vesalago, but was really worked out by Pendry in 2000, and this is probably one of the most cited papers in the last 10 years, because all kind of people try to now create superlenses with all kind of different ways, and I give you a little bit of an overview of what people are doing. So the way how that basically works, you have your object here, and you just basically do geometrical optics. You just do some ray traces in there, and you get your image on the other side, okay? So this is from the geometrical point of view how the lens works. However, there's more to it. Why do we call that superlens? We call it superlens because it has a resolution that in principle can beat the diffraction limit. And in principle, it can beat it infinitely, okay? In principle, you can get infinitely good resolution. Just a very short sketch of an argument why that is. If you have a normal lens, you can describe your resolution with kx if your propagation direction is z, okay? Then the best or the largest kx that you can get is omega squared over c squared minus kz squared, right? That means that even if you set kz equal to 0, you never can get better than this one here. So, and therefore, you have the resolution limit that is of the order of lambda. This is different if you go into the near field, et cetera, but for all practical purposes, far field, et cetera, that is what we get. So what we have for the superlens, which works with negative refraction, is that we get an amplification of the evanescent wave. Okay, they get lost in the normal wave. However, if you look at the same equation and look at the evanescent waves, then this one is ikz. And of course, this minus goes into the plus. And therefore, this kx can get basically as large as you want. Okay, there is absolutely no limit. And Pendry shows very, very nicely with classical argument, and making sure that causality is still valid, etc., that this indeed is possible. Okay, so now the only problem that remains is how do we do that? Let me show you one. Yeah, of course.
So this picture in no way it violates uncertainty principle. Does it mean that we can localize a photon at a given point?
No, we cannot localize it better than it's localized originally. Okay, the image can never be better than the object. Okay, so if you can localize an electron or a photon within the uncertainty limit, then you can do that in principle with the image as well, but you can't do it better. Okay, it's still only an image.
Well, but somehow I'm drawing parallels between diffraction limit and uncertainty principle. If you have propagating light, I would imagine the reason you cannot put the light at one point is because that would violate the uncertainty principle for the photon. Somehow you can put it on one point.
I mean, you know, it obviously doesn't, because people are showing that, okay? So, well, I haven't thought about that kind of philosophical direction. It's a good question, but I think what you have to really take into account, I think you can probably not localize photons or something like that. closer than lambda, okay? Because please do note that the resolution that goes beyond the diffraction limit comes from the evanescent waves, okay? And the evanescent waves do not describe you an exact localization of any kind of object or so, okay? It's just basically the superposition that this gives the object. But at the end, it's again just only the object or the image in that case that you can localize and not any kind of photon. And this is kind of hand-waving, okay? The point is, it seems to work. Of course, nobody ever has seen infinitely resolved picture, okay? But what people have seen is a picture that is resolved a couple of times, I mean, 5-6 times better than the diffraction limit, okay? And not in the near field and the far field.
So if I now, take a single atom, which is much less than the wavelength, mm-hmm. and I image it, I mean, the image, again, will be the size of the atom?
In principle, yes. Again, theoretically, yes. That particular case hasn't been shown yet. I think what people have done, they have used this kind of microwave structures and were able to somehow show something of the order of half a centimeter or something like that, okay? I mean, for half a centimeter, of course, it's a little bit funny to talk about Heisenberg yet, but
for this argument to be valid, yeah. I mean, this lens has to be infinite.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah, you're right. It has to be infinitely high. It has to be infinitely perfect, n equals minus 1 all over. It has to have infinitely straight surfaces, et cetera, okay? It has to be
losses.
Totally perfect.
If you had any losses in there, then the losses would also destroy this aspect.
Yeah.
How does the phase spec look like?
Oh, you just basically you yeah. Yeah. You get the evanescent wave usually give you an e to the minus. In the vacuum, what you get is e to the minus kz z, right? And inside, this actually plays the other way around, and you get actually a plus here. So you indeed do have amplification, exponential amplification of that, okay? Sounds weird in the beginning, but the point is evanescent waves do not carry any energy. So without kind of causality violation or energy violation or so, you can do all kind of amplification that you want with them. But this is also the reason, of course, why this material is extremely sensitive to all kind of dirt and fluctuations and losses, etc. Okay, because all of that, of course, goes up exponentially as well. Depends on what kind of. I mean, first of all, I think so far there are not any materials that can do that for any kind of very wide range of wavelengths, just because the index of refraction, of course, is frequency dependent, right? So, and usually n equals minus 1, you cannot get for any kind of. No, it's mostly actually not periodicity. It's a question of resonance, okay? It can be done a little bit better in some cases, especially in the near field, but nevertheless, still this n equals minus 1, exactly n equals minus 1, you usually have only for exactly one wavelength, okay? And then, of course, I think you always, depending on what resolution you really want to get, you have a certain kind of window where you can do that. But as far as I know, nobody has done that with anything else but monochromatic light yet, okay? So I think the kind of hope is that people have is that you can, first you can do imaging not with electron lithography or something like that, but with light and whatever UV or even visible light instead. In that case, single frequency is perfectly fine, or perhaps doing medical imaging or something like that. Again, with light rather than with something more destructive. Okay. Any questions at that point? Okay. So one of the things that one can think about, actually it's also important, and this becomes clear if you look at that. The lens actually has to be exactly half as thick that it's just half the distance between the object and the image plane. Okay, and you can of course also do some kind of geometry. You can now make a rounded surface and so on, and you can get some magnification. But in principle, you always need to also have these distances exactly kept clear. Okay, so now of course you can imagine, for example, putting an atom on the other side as well, and then you get, for example, something like super radiance or so over the kind of finite distance, because you kind of image that one directly on top of the other, and they act as if they are really sitting on top of each other.
So yeah. Because of this requirement, if I had this material for all wavelengths, uh-huh. I'd be able to build a super telescope. Would I be able to?
I mean, if you would be able to do it for all kind of relevant wavelengths, you should be.
But you're saying that the width has to be exactly the distance between the object.
Ah, yeah, you're right. Sorry. Yes, you're right. So, I mean, there are actually a couple of other ideas out there, and I think you probably, playing with geometry, you can probably do quite a bit. But telescope, yeah, probably not. That's a good point, yeah. No, I wouldn't see how you would do that. Okay. I mean, there might be still other ideas out there that I don't know yet. But I think for that particular...
deep magnification that I have a structure and I can image this...
Yeah, you can, as I say, if you use something else than just a flat slab, you can do it. But still, for all practical purposes, the thickness has to be the same order of magnitude as the distance between the object and the image plane.
But in principle, you can do something like lithography.
Yeah, you can do that.
So,
in fact, actually, lithography is probably one of by far the easiest. Let me tell you something which I just wanted to mention at the end, but I will do it immediately, okay? What we have here is n smaller than 0, in particular n equals to minus 1. This is if you want to go into the far field. If you stay in the near field, it's actually enough if you have epsilon equals to minus 1, which is considerably easier. In that case, and for lithography, I mean, there's no reason. You can, in principle, put your object in your image plane as close together as you like. I mean, within, let's say, a visible or UV wavelengths is still kind of very close, but in principle, you can do that, okay? In that case, you only need epsilon equals to minus 1. And then, for example, if you want to work with visible light or so, you can just put the layer of silver. The reason is, well, I tell you the reason if you really want to know later. Okay, so I call this one origin. I was giving that talk once to Hal Metcalf and other people in Stony Brook, and he jumped up and said, "Oh, but this is wrong. This is all. This picture is wrong. You get that all wrong." We could afterwards work it out. It's not the origin, okay? But nevertheless, it's the way how you calculate it, okay? So let me put it that way. So. The way how we calculate the index of refraction is that we just take the square root of the permittivity times the permeability, and usually that's no problem. Usually this is either epsilon and mu both are positive, then n is positive, or one is positive, the other one is negative, then this is just imaginary and everything is absorbed and we don't have a problem. However, if epsilon and mu both are negative, then because of causality, we have to choose the negative square root of this, okay? And in this case, we would have the negative square root of epsilon times mu. So that means all our job just consists now of making epsilon negative and mu negative. How do we do that? This is very easy. So this is the resonance that I showed you before. So usually if we have one resonance, normal dispersion, that just goes up, goes through one on resonance, and then goes up again. And if we make this resonance strong enough, we would have the zero perhaps somewhere here, and then we would just choose this dip down here for a negative, most possible negative epsilon, and the same thing we do with mu. Okay? Unfortunately, it's not so easy. First of all, usually the resonances for electric properties and resonances for the magnetic properties are not anywhere close to each other. So even if we could get that negative and that negative we still would have to have it for the same frequency range, right? Second, especially for higher frequency, this mu gets very, very weak. This is just more or less impossible to really get that anywhere, even close to zero, let alone below zero. And this is basically what people are fighting with. This is easier in the microwave regime. The more you go towards visible or UV or even higher, the more impossible is the mu part of this one here. One of the reasons is that basically, at least in the optical regime, basically mu minus 1 goes like the fine structure constant times epsilon minus 1. So if you have a sizable epsilon, that means that mu is still pretty small. So what has been done? And this is this is an industry, okay? So I very, very briefly only show what people have done. This is probably the most important because it's the first one might be the best working one and also the best known one. So what I've just shown, we do now explicitly, okay? We make an electric dipole by just taking a piece of copper wire and pulling it straight and making all the geometry right so that we have exactly the resonance frequency that we want. And we do the same thing with the magnetic dipole. Usually one of these split rings would already make a fairly good magnetic dipole, but if we want it strong, we need a strong capacitance, and you get that if you have these two split rings put inside each other. Again, you make your geometry so that the resonance frequency fits exactly what you want, and in particular, you make them just geometrically such that both of these have the same resonance frequency. This is just a normal AC circuit, right? I mean, this is cheap and easy and has been done and looks like this. This is actually Penry and Smith and some other people, but these two are the kind of pioneers by building these structures. I just was going to say that. So this is about a centimeter between two of these walls. So this is definitely a structure that works for microwaves, but not anywhere above that. For two reasons. First, because the resonance frequency is in a microwave regime. But second, also, in order to give any kind of resolution or so, of course, our material has to be homogeneous compared to whatever resolution we want. Okay. So in that case, we can expect resolution at best a single centimeter or something like that. Okay. So here, these kind of dark lines that you see here in the middle are the electric dipoles, and these square split rings are the magnetic dipoles, and that works well. Okay, this is in the meantime already a good 10 years old and has been also refined, etc. The group of Larger Life went quite a bit further. They basically made more or less the same. So this and this is the same, okay, even if it doesn't look like that. How come? What that is, you see only the upper layer, but this is two close lying layers of these kind of little silver rods on some kind of dielectric. I forgot what that is. And not silver, gold. I think this is gold, sorry. And these are about a micrometer long and about 100 nanometers thick. And the point is, what he does, he just puts two of these layers directly above each other, and his microcircuits therefore look like this. Okay? So what we have here is basically each of these is one of the electric dipoles. And if you have that small enough and fast enough, you get quite a sizable displacement current between these two. So this one basically also gives you this magnetic dipole structure in this case. Okay? So this was basically the big idea here, that you can actually simplify your circuits to that one here. And he does that by electron lithography, so it's still not very easy, but nevertheless, this structure, I think this particular works for about telecommunication wavelengths. By now, I think they claim they are either very close to visible or they are already in the visible, but I think they have pretty much the same structure here. Okay. Then let me mention two more that don't fall exactly into that. But nevertheless have quite made some waves, so I want to talk about that. So one is the photonic, the band structure of a photonic crystal. So here's a photonic crystal, and this is from Notomi's group in Japan, who were, I believe, the first ones who showed that you can do a kind of a negative refraction with photonic band structure. So what you do, and I know for this audience this is a little bit too simplistic, but basically what you do, you flip over the k vector direction on the Fermi surface so that you come from a relatively right-handed system. In that case, these are not, EBK are not perpendicular anyway anymore. So from a relatively right-handed system to a relatively left-handed system, okay? And then you just have to choose your direction right, and in the right direction for the right frequency, you get indeed n equals minus 1 or n equals whatever, something negative. That works. However, strictly speaking, and actually I asked Vlad Shalayev, so what about these photonic band gaps, okay? And he got totally mad, said, oh, these people, they're always claiming this is matter material, and they're always sending me this stuff to referee, and it's all wrong. And it took him a while to quiet down enough to explain me why he says it's all wrong. It's actually not all wrong, okay? You do get negative refraction. But the problem is it's not a matter material, because a matter material is supposed to be smooth, as compared to the wavelength range that you are looking at, okay? This one, of course, is not, because by the very definition of photonic band gaps, this one, at least within the index of refraction of the semiconductor that you have there, is of the order of the wavelengths, right? This is how photonic band gaps work. So while you do get negative refraction, you will not get super lensing, because your resolution will never be better than your structure. So your structure might be, depending on the index of refraction, perhaps lambda over 3 or lambda over 4. And I think that has been shown by now, but there's just a fundamental limit at this point. So this is a nice material, but for super lenses it doesn't work. Another one is what is called not super lens, but hyperlens. And it's called hyperlens because of this nice hyperbolic equation, which I show you here. But of course, it's also a nice work. And what this is done by the group of Narimanov in Princeton. What that is based off is actually somewhat different. This still works with a high resolution, but it does not depend on negative index. Okay. So what you have in very, very short is you have a cylindrical anisotropy, and here, and I forgot something, okay? This one, this minus is only if you put an absolute value around that. Here what you have is effectively a cylindrical anisotropy of the permittivity. So you have basically a positive angular epsilon and a negative radial epsilon. And in that case, already if you think back to this equation that I showed you before, you have something similar. You have basically this plus replaced by a minus, and therefore KR, which is usually very seriously limited in a cylindrical geometry, in this case is not limited at all. And the way how you do that, this different E theta and ER, is that you have basically a cylindrical material that just has alternating layer of dielectric and metal, where the dielectric has a positive epsilon, the metal has a negative epsilon, and then effectively you get this E theta in here, which has opposite signs. And this one also, I mean, this works actually very well. This is a proposal that came out in September 06, and 6 months later, two groups had already done an experiment with that. So this works very nice. However, this is limited by the ratio if you have your metal lens, by the ratio of the radius of the outer layer and the inner layer of your lens. But nevertheless, I mean, they see already something like also factor of 6 or so improvement from the usual diffraction limit. So this is actually very nice, even though it's a little bit different. Okay, so what are we doing? First of all, what's the problem with all of that? The problem with all of that is that while all of these have already pretty nice refraction, they also have, unfortunately, not so nice absorption. Okay, so in all of these proposals and experiment and so on, the absorption is roughly the same order of magnitude as the refraction. I think, I mean, I was actually friendly, I said 5. I don't think that anybody yet actually managed to get a factor of 5 between these two. I think 1 is more. So what we want to do is we want to basically eliminate absorption. Okay, of course we cannot eliminate it completely either, but we can eliminate it very far. This 100 is actually kind of an arbitrary number for the particular parameters that we put in, but I will show you why we make this claim. So first of all, I told you before I would briefly explain you this electromagnetically induced transparency. My apologies to those who live and breathe that anyway. So the idea is, of course, usually matter absorbs resonant light, and if you shine in another laser with the right properties, the light goes through and shows both up on the screen back there, and therefore it's called electromagnetically induced transparency. And the idea of that is basically you have a two-level system, and if you change the frequency of that, you get a transmission profile which looks like that. It's the same that I showed you before. And dispersion profile which looks like that. Now we add the third level, which we couple by another laser coherent, then our transmission profile changes to this one here, okay? So we still have absorption, but the absorption is now pushed out to the side where it's exactly on resonance we have exact transparency. The dispersion also changes accordingly, and actually the high dispersion that you have here in the middle at the end is responsible for all this kind of slow and stopped light, etc. So that's basically all what I want to say for it. But now, please, what I'm relying on later is that if we have a system like this so-called lambda system, what we need actually is two photon resonance between these two, then we get transparency, okay? And that's basically what we need. And this is also, the mechanism with which we suppress the absorption in our scheme. Okay, this is not so important. So now let's revisit this equation here. So I told you before that n is calculated by the square root of epsilon times mu, but this is not the whole story. This is only if you have a normal medium, okay? The normal medium is basically given by the polarization of the medium is the susceptibility times E field, the magnetization is susceptibility times H, actually. Apologize. But now, if you take chiral media, the fact which distinguishes chiral media from normal media is that here we have a cross-coupling. Namely, the polarization also depends on the magnetic field, and the magnetization also depends on the electric field. And to clarify what I mean by chiral, this is, I think, mostly clear for whatever organic chemistry, etc. For example, normal sugar is chiral, so that means that if you put some light with a certain polarization in there, you send that through the medium, for example, a sugar solution or so, and the angle of your polarization is turned at the end, okay? So I think they even measure some kind of diabetes stuff or so with just measuring the chirality.
So any material exactly that said. Does not have an inversion symmetry will have this?
Yeah. However, unfortunately, okay, we of course need that for negative refraction, but unfortunately the natural chirality that we get does not give us a negative index of refraction, okay? This is only the first step. That's important first step, okay? So, because now if you calculate the index of refraction of this one, it changes, and it changes the following way. And just to simplify that, if we choose the face of these chi e b's right, then in principle we can write that down as this this formula. And here, of course, we already see that now we just basically have to make this epsilon times mu very small, which is easy. I mean, because epsilon is so very easy to manipulate, okay? So we just try to manipulate it such that it's somewhere, for example, close to zero or something like that. Then we don't need to touch mu, which I told you before is so very hard, okay? So then this one is fairly close to zero, and then we just have to make sure that this one is strong enough that it actually gives us a negative index of refraction, okay? That's all. However, as I told you, what is important is the phase, okay? Otherwise, it doesn't look like that, or it even gives a higher index or something like that, or it gives more absorption in most cases. So this is the crucial point in which we work, and of course, since this is a quantum optics proposal, we do this cross-coupling here optically, okay? All right, so all the rest is basically just this is the important point, okay? And then there are probably, I believe, probably about 1,000 ideas how you could do that, okay? And I just give you one particular that looks like it might work fairly well.
The relationship between n and epsilon and psi is not purely imaginary.
No, it's not. Psi in principle is for natural material, that's actually real, okay? However, as I told you, this is optical, okay? So we will do that by an optical field. And optical field, we are free in principle to choose the phase, okay? And we, of course, choose it such that it's imaginary and the right direction imaginary too, okay? Here, the point is, this is actually also, this is a similar rough estimate as before, okay? While mu is about fine structure constant squared times chi, these xi's are about the fine structure constant times chi e, okay? So already in principle, we can do factor of 10 to the 2 better, okay? However, the reason why I don't go into that, usually if you have a system like that, it follows Onsager relation, which means basically these two are symmetric and definitely have the same absolute value. Okay, in that case, this is pretty strict. We have a normal optical system with decays and with incoherent broadening, etc., etc. And in that case, these are not symmetric anymore, and in fact have quite different orders of magnitude. So in that case, this is true on the average. Okay, so now what we do, we just basically have this E and B, and E and B, of course, now in our case, are the electrical and magnetic components of an electromagnetic wave. And what we do, we assume the simplest possible system where we can have all three, namely B and E, and this kind of coupling. So we assume we have an electric dipole allowed transition which couples the electric part of the field and a magnetic dipole allowed transition which couples the magnetic part of the field. And then we put an optical field or some kind of coherent field which couples these two. It's intuitively clear that by that there must be now some cross-correlation between E and B. Okay, so this is basically all. Now, just a small couple of details. This is what I just said. Now, this omega basically is this xi, more or less. It's proportional to that. It's, of course, not exactly, but that's basically it. So here we get this chiral behavior. What is kind of important for practical reasons, or practical reasons being that we don't want to have absorption, is that an electrical E1 transition is so-called dipole allowed, and so that means that here we have very strong decay, okay? I call that gamma. If we only look at the decay along this transition, this is very weak because this is a dipole forbidden transition. I mean, M1 transitions count among the forbidden transitions. So for practical purposes, this gamma zero is much smaller than the gamma. Of course, that means that we don't have any other strong decays into other levels from here, okay? This is clear. In this case, the level 2, 3, and 1 make this kind of EIT-type lambda system, okay? In that case, this would be the excited state, and this would be the metastable ground state. And
the assumption, don't you think, is that you say that there exists a level 2 that has the same frequency as...
I come to that, okay? This is a big but, okay? And this is why this particular level scheme doesn't work, and we at the end we find another one, okay?
And why do you plot it as a V system and not as a lambda system?
You could turn it around. I mean, you could have that as the excited state and these as ground states. Doesn't matter. But it has to be somehow triangular, okay? And of course, this one and this one have to have the same frequency because the same field.
It would be that the decay rates would be at different levels.
Since
you say EIT here.
Yeah, okay. I mean, for EIT, this is the right way, okay? Imagine this to be the excited state that decays strongly into here. This one basically doesn't decay, or perhaps there's some kind of mixing or something like that, okay? And this one would be the two metastable ground states of the EIT, okay? So you basically have to look that way in order to see EIT. No, I mean, just for the moment, look only at E and just ignore this one here, okay? Without that, it would be EIT, okay? Because this coupling here will never be strong by itself because of this alpha squared factor. so here, this is actually the first proof. We have plotted the chi-E for this, and here we see this typical dip in the absorption of EIT. You will see that again. Okay, so there are, of course, problems. And the two hardest of them, one of which was just mentioned by Peter, the other one is, so far, this omega is a DC coupling. And while that is by itself already hard to do because we want a fairly strong coupling, in addition, DC coupling doesn't give us any phase, okay? And especially not the pi over 2 phase, which we would need in order to turn this psi imaginary from real, okay? So that will not quite do the fact, but obviously that can be solved. Also, if we have inhomogeneously broadened system, which we actually need at the end, it doesn't work so well. But also, a level scheme that has exactly this property is actually very hard to find. I don't say impossible, but I was going through all the nest tables and turned the crank. Okay, I didn't find any such exact system. But, yeah. You're right. It does exist, okay? But it does not exist for whatever visible frequencies or something like that, okay? Yeah.
What's the meaning behind hydrogen? You mean the excited state with general synthesis?
Yeah.
In fact, there, you know, this omega doesn't have to be strictly, you know, DC. It could be some kind of variable microwave.
Yeah. In principle, one can think about hydrogen. In principle that would work, okay? In practice, not so sure, but in principle it would. Okay, so the reason for that is that now, of course, and now I apologize, now it looks complicated, even though it's not, okay? So it doesn't work with 3 levels. We still need the kind of same distribution of parity, so we have to at least 2 levels at the time. So in that case, we add 2 levels, and we can, in principle, add 2 levels anywhere. This is just one scheme that works particularly well, but doesn't have to be that way. Here what we do, we basically just split up this level 1 and use 3 levels instead and couple these 3 levels also by coherent fields. This level 5 is totally arbitrary, can be chosen by whatever the facts in the lab are, etc., what kind of extra levels there are, and so on and so on. And now we have, of course, 2 advantages, okay? The first advantage is that while we still have resonant E1 and M1 transitions, they don't have to have a common level anymore, okay? The second is that now our omega is not a DC field anymore, which solves the problems for this. And this is now a normal electric dipole allowed transition, so we can find fairly strong transition for it. And these level schemes, actually, they do exist. They don't exist all that easily, but, for example, I found one at about 700 nanometers. I don't exactly know the wavelengths in this prosium, which gives pretty much exactly this level scheme.
But the assumption here is still that the frequency 3.2 is the same as
4.1. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely.
Why not make 4 an intermediate of resonant state? I mean, it can be somewhere.
Sure. It can be. I mean, it does not have exactly this order, okay? So you can basically, while you need this kind of chain of five here, you can sort them around. I mean, this is now. You have to keep the topology, but you can turn around the energy levels as well. Actually, I think you can, but not very much. Okay, that's actually kind of important, because it has the usual 1/(delta) dependence there. Okay, so you can make it of resonance, but it shouldn't be all that much of resonance.
But would this not help? Because then you would make the E-coupling weaker and maybe more comparable to the magnetic field.
No, we don't want that. We don't want that E-coupling weaker. Because if we make the E-coupling weaker, all what we make is that basically the light field doesn't couple in there at all anymore. I mean, no, we don't want that either.
We wanted to make the two psi's that we had equal.
No, we don't need that.
I thought that they need opposite sign being equal being I psi.
That was just in order to have the simplified, okay? I should have said that, I apologize. So I wrote you down the simplified form, which is epsilon mu minus xi. We don't take this one, okay? We take the full formula and just there. I mean, we have a little bit more freedom. This is just to show you how in principle that works. Actually, as long as we don't have decays, these psi's are automatically necessarily equal or symmetric, okay, because of Onsager theorem. So the only thing which makes them asymmetric is that we have, for example, we assume that we have some certain Doppler broadening for the different frequencies differently, etc. Okay, and of course we have strong decay along this one here and very weak decay along this one, etc., etc. Okay, from that, this becomes different.
Basically, what you want to have this psi to be resonantly enhanced and at the same time not having absorption.
Yeah, exactly. So we, of course, I mean, that means, you see, we have already quite a couple of parameters to play with. So what you have to, of course, find the particular places where that goes, but I will show it to you now. Sorry, I just... this is all not so important. So what we did, we in addition added a couple of decays here, and then we have inhomogeneous line broadening on there. And what we get for these is like that. And now I apologize for the scales, because the scales that we have here are actually what we call alpha. So these chi's and xi's are of course proportional to the density, and now it's proportional to the transition matrix elements, whereas this one, for this one, you would have to subtract that out. Okay, so that means that this one is actually considerably bigger than this one at the end. So here, this is what I showed you already. This is the electric response. This is the pure magnetic response, which is basically vanishing. But even if you would blow that up, what you would see is that just a normal non-inverted two-level system. So that means that this direct M1 transition is basically not affected at all. Okay, so our mu is basically 1, chi m is basically 0. And now we just plug that into this long formula, and this is what we get out for a certain set of parameters which are chosen as realistically as possible. So the imaginary part basically gives us the absorption, the real part gives us the refraction, and here you see if you look at -1, we basically have here a frequency region where we get that. This is delta over this gamma magnetic, or what I called gamma zero before, so this total frequency range here is actually rather narrow, okay? This is just to highlight that there is actually a part where we can do that. This is the wrong direction. Let me show you the level scheme one more. Delta is basically the difference in the let me think. I think it's the two-level detuning from level three, okay, or alternatively from level two, which gives the same, okay. Here for this picture that I did, E and B are completely resonant. It would look reasonably similar if you would keep all the resonances, but would for example shift now level four around. Okay, it looks a bit different. And this region where we get something gets a bit smaller, but in principle it gives the same. So we still assume that we have a closed five field loop there. But one of the levels now, or two of the levels, are moved around, but only by the same delta. Okay, so this is basically, and you actually can even do it if you allow yourself any kind of phase, etc. In the three-level system, is actually not quite as clean, but it looks very similar. You would get in that case a little bit more absorption. So these additional levels they allow to kind of what happens in the three-level system is that we would have to push that a little bit in this direction, okay? So we would push the no absorption and the low index region, unfortunately, somewhat apart. The five-level system helps, so if you would introduce even more level, it might even be better, but I don't know, okay? That becomes a little bit too much engineering then. But in principle, that works fairly well for this. Okay, so now just to show you how I got this factor of 100, here we chose, here we chose a frequency which is, I think, somewhere here, where we on this picture still have a positive N, and change the density instead. So what we see is that depending on the density, the N in that case would go down. However, the imaginary part has even a maximum, okay, and this is already blown up by a factor of 100, okay. And if we go to the somewhere around here and just plot the logarithm of the real part versus the imaginary part, then as we go up with the density in that kind of frequency range, we go up to 100. We can do that for different frequency ranges and for different parameters, also for other densities. However, it's kind of necessary that we have fairly high densities. I mean, these are crazily high. I think in practice one can go a little bit better. What you also would have to do is you would have to go into a local field correction regime, which we did, but which I don't show you now. One more thing that one can do, there's one parameter that we didn't use so far. This is this extra coupling omega, which actually is a good tuning here as well. Here we actually, I think this is for this parameter region here. And here we just change the omega, and you see here where it is zero, this is basically the gamma, this is the decay rate of the along the electric dipole transition, and you see that we don't need that particularly strong. Okay, this is even for CW fairly easy to reach regime, but whatever we cannot reach by other means, we can reach by just changing this omega around bit, and then of course at the end there's the question, yeah.
The N is not equal to minus one, is that this is needed exactly? So if it's not, then would this then magnify, or what would it do? I mean,
it would not. It just would not all put it, image it all at the same place.
So okay. Then the super resolution is lost.
Yeah.
So you need this to be minus one up to a certain number of
pitches. There are actually a couple of papers who calculate that this is kind of a crazy number, okay? So,
it's some universal number.
Yeah, yeah. What you get basically in that case is some kind of parallax, okay? I should have put a picture of that in. I didn't, I'm sorry. And I also didn't put the number, but it's really... it's actually pretty sad. So at the end, one would have to see how one gets around that. And of course, the less resolution you need. I mean, if you don't need infinite resolution, but beat the diffraction limit only by a factor of 10 of course you can tolerate a lot more of that, okay? But then of course you don't need to call it super lens anymore because it's only a little bit better, whatever.
But in case of lithography, if you win a factor of 10,
right.
Pay you a lot. So.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly the point.
It's also somehow where there is very sensitive dependence on its absorption, right? So absorption should also.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, right. I mean, you see that in our scheme, absorption is not such a big deal. But of course, if you have an absorption which is equally big as the index, then you always already your light strength goes down by a factor of E if you have n equals minus 1.
I think it's also the resolution. You lose the resolution.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, you do. Yeah. I mean, that's I think mostly the reason why you lose resolution then is mostly statistical. But I'm swimming a little bit here. Okay. So we have a little bit thought about realization schemes, and the ones that we came up with so far is either in Adams. There's a very nice scheme in Neon, which is very nicely resonant. However, it's 5.4 micron or so. Now, as I told you, there's this one in this prosium. Actually, what I did, I kind of wrote a little program which looks through all these kind of lists of lines and so on and chooses them by which possible transition. And the reason why I go into all these heavy ones is that M1 transitions are in principle degenerate. Okay, so it's only the so-called relativistic corrections that give you that give you any kind of non-zero transition frequency M1 line. Okay, they are of course the strongest for the heaviest atoms, and so we look at the heavy atoms. So this prosium is a pretty good example. I found two or three fairly good schemes which are all in the visible regions for that, and of course for lower frequencies it's easy anyway. Molecules work also pretty well in principle because they have these rotational levels which always give you even parity, odd parity, even parity, odd parity, even parity, etc. And this is of course what we need. And the only problem is that we have so far is to find a fairly efficient scheme to give us the right phase for this size. So this is still in work. And this bound excitons, never mind, this is what I'm personally hoping for, but this is kind of on the back burner. So the basic part of this is in collaboration with Jürgen Kessel, Michael Fleischhauer from Kaiserslautern, and Ron Walsworth from the CFA in Cambridge. And at various points of this program, various of my graduate students were involved, so I list them here as well. And now I would like to use the remaining minus two minutes that I have, I apologize, to just throw two things out in the space, okay? And these are really not thought through very well at all because, as I said, they came up in discussions basically this week. So one of the things that would be really, really nice would be if we could, I mean, some of us are thinking about polar molecules and harvesting the dipole-dipole interaction between them. Okay, so here I have my two polar molecules, which are pretty far away. So the dipole-dipole interaction is unfortunately pretty weak. But now we put this super lens in between. And the super lens, actually, I say that in a second, okay? So what I get here is I basically get an image which is now very close to the other. And now, of course, this dipole-dipole interaction is wonderfully big. And if we assume exchange interaction, what we actually need, again, microwaves. So that has two advantages. First, for microwaves, it's actually much easier. But in addition, we actually don't even need n equals 1 because, in principle, for the time scales that we need, and for microwaves, near field is fine, okay? Let's assume we want distances to go from, we want, for example, dipole-dipole interaction that is like, it's like, let's say, 100 nanometers apart, or even 10, okay? However, the actual distance that we have, let's say, is perhaps 10 micrometers or something like this, okay? So 10 micrometers for microwaves is perfectly near field, okay? We don't have to worry about the far field at all. In this case, we don't need n equals minus 1. We only need epsilon equals to minus 1. Okay? Now, of course, we run into the opposite problem. that we have before, and this is where the big question mark is. So epsilon equals minus 1 is very easy with these kind of microwave schemes that I showed you before, if you just make lattices of wires, okay? But the point is these wires have to be of the order of centimeters apart, and if we want to have a lens that works on the order of micrometers, of course that again doesn't work, okay? So the point is, if that would be visible, then we would take a silver layer, because silver for visible frequency is epsilon equals minus 1, perfect, okay? So if anybody knows about some kind of, for example, plasma frequency that is particularly low or something like that, so that we can do something like that, and then one could do crazy things with all this kind of dipole quantum computing or so. No, you don't need minus 1 exactly, but the closer you come to minus 1, see, the point is, I mean, we have discussed that, right? It's very easy to get minus 10,000 or so at that case, okay? But minus 10,000 doesn't do the job, because minus 10,000, what it basically does is, if here is your lens, and here is your object, and you ray trace, minus 10,000 means that the sine of this angle here is 10,000 times as big as the sine of this angle here, okay? And you see that there's not all that much going on here, okay? So it will come out, so that means that our image is somewhere over there, okay? So, for a telescope, that might actually work. that's an interesting idea. So perhaps we should, after all, come back not to the. But then, of course, the near field doesn't work anymore. Okay, then we unfortunately. The wavelengths that give a near field for telescopic kind of astronomic applications is probably not particularly interesting for any of us. So. Yeah, I mean, yeah, that's true. I mean, one certainly can play around with this. I mean, but the point is, in that case, if you get something like that, okay, it doesn't even matter whether it's negative or positive. Right.
What's effective epsilon for like superconductor?
Yeah, I mean, we were thinking about that, and we couldn't come up with any kind of. That is, and while kind of these microwave structures are difficult, superconducting temperatures for this kind of application not a problem. So, this is the one. This is actually still kind of reasonable one. The other one is even more crazy and throws up even more questions. So that is based on a recent proposal by the group of Altschuler, who wants to use graphene for an electron lens. Okay, probably most of you even know that. The basic idea is that, so here I have the graphene dispersion relation, and if you go into the n-doped regime, you have basically n equals to 1 for electrons now. Okay? If you go into the p-doped regime, you basically have n equals minus 1, because what you get here is a group velocity which is minus omega over k absolute times the direction of k. Okay. So what they do is they suggest now all kind of nice stuff like lenses for electrons where you have an NP junction in graphene, and or even an NPN junction where you really have this kind of negative index lens where the n-doped part plays the part of the vacuum and that one plays the part of the lens. And the thing works, of course, nicely because the electrons are effectively massless in that. Okay, so they act like photons. So this is very nice. He even has some kind of geometric setup where he gets some kind of nice beam splitter, etc. So this is actually quite nice. But after all, I mean, we are doing atoms, right? So now we go back to Lu Ming. And he talked about that, so I don't have to talk about that anymore. Okay, that was in his Monday talk. So he has a certain situation of called gases in an hexagonal lattice with asymmetric tunneling coefficients in the different directions. Okay, so he actually gets the graphene situation exactly for the symmetric case. So if we want that, this is the easiest part. And now, of course, this one is not for electrons, this one is for cold atoms, okay? So now we do our lensing, or want to do our lensing for cold atoms. Of course, this is now, there are now about 157 questions that come up quite immediately that I all cannot answer. But here, basically, the idea is, here we don't even need the endo part, okay? For the endo part, in principle, we can take vacuum and just have our lens here. I'm sorry. So the idea how that's supposed to look like is basically like this, okay? So we basically kind of lens our cold atomic samples through this thing. Of course, in order to to have this p-doped situation, in principle, we need a filling factor which is just slightly below 1/2, which is very different and very difficult. So what one could do instead is to just to adiabatically flash on this hexagonal lattice with the right parameters exactly at the right times, and then switch it off again and perhaps do kind of pulse shapes with that or something like that.
Out of atoms in the lattice,
yeah.
And you would like to refocus in the right.
Exactly, yeah, sorry. So we basically
then
have...
You could simply grab it and move it there.
Oh, sure. But in case this is not sure, okay? So this is just a question. But there's, of course, now all. And the fact is that, of course, while in the ideal case, our atoms are massless in there, they're, of course, not massless out in the vacuum, okay? So the question is whether one would, after all, not quite go to the graphene case, but go to the finite band gap case so that one has some kind of negative mass, but then one has to deal with instabilities, etc. So this is something where one really has to put quite a bit of work in if that's worth following. Okay, and with that I want to thank you.
Any more questions?
Yeah.
In the case what you discussed before with the EIT, so I guess you would need some kind of gas. You had fairly high densities.
Yeah. Yeah.
How about temperatures? Is the width of your
temperature
larger than the
The Dopplerwitz that we assumed here is now about the same as the lifetimes of the strongly decaying states. Okay, this is about the case for Kelvin or so for the most interesting. So I actually have been talking to Mara, and as it just so happens, they have just, as you probably know, Mara Prentice and John Doyle have just the right setup for this to get us exactly. I mean, it turns out to be kind of the ideal broadening, okay? You can, of course, have more or less. However, if you have more, at some point the effect gets lost. If you have less, this Unsager theorem violation doesn't work so well anymore. Okay. So this is kind of, it's kind of ideal. I mean, we didn't quite optimize it, but this is a kind of broadening of this order. It seems to work best.
But in principle, what you need is gas at fairly high pressure.
I mean, these densities about 10 to the 15, 10 to the 16 is a bit crazy, okay? So what at the end we would need is a little bit better coupling than what we have here, okay? Which we assume fairly moderately. So I think alone from that one can get probably at least one order of magnitude. And other than that, we have to see what we do. It's a bit playing around. But then, of course, we have the same problem as we had before. Not quite.
Maybe not. It can be the regime where our structures are smaller than the wavelength you're considering.
Yeah. I mean, the point is, if the gas is reasonably cold, then this is homogeneous even without the density being very high.
Some magnetic response is coming. The photonic response.
Yeah. Sure. I mean, if we have a stronger magnetic response, then we don't need this cross coupling so much. So this is sure.
Just have a question about this atom. So if you would move this atom or this cloud of atoms just to the surface, and simply let it diffuse, and after a while it will refocus exactly at one point on the opposite surface.
That of course assumes that it has already a kind of average momentum in this direction. So you probably can kind of just shift this whole, I don't know exactly, okay, whether you can, I mean, you can leave the atoms spread, okay, and you just move the optical lattice instead. Okay, so you can do either of the two. But as I said, I mean, it won't work that ideally anyway. Okay, I mean, there will be some kind of whatever optimal control or something like that.
One is that the atomic dispersion relation is p squared divided by 2m.
Yeah, yeah. That's what I said. I mean, that's of course that's what makes that different from the electron proposal. But, yeah, yeah. That's what I mentioned before. So one might have to go into the non-zero gap regime, okay, a small gap regime or something like that. Yeah.
What do you have on the x-axis? Is it really a spatial coordinate, or could it also just be a time coordinate?
Yeah, that's what I say. It could be time coordinate, but we do need a finite k, I think, between the optical lattice and the atoms, okay? In that case, you would have to somehow move your optical lattice through. But for example, you probably wouldn't work with a sharp surface. You would work with some kind of adiabatic switching on or something like that. Yeah, I mean, the point is, of course, also, again, how perfect you want to be focusing, okay? If you just want them roughly go all in the same direction, then it's probably reasonably easy if you want something like, let's say, a centimeter or even 10 centimeter or half a meter further to the right is probably much harder, okay?
I can really experiment that kind of thing.
So what is the application, this Altschuler proposal?
I hear what he says he can lens and beam split electrons. But electrons means, of course, electrons, graphene electrons, right? He doesn't, if I haven't missed anything, he doesn't go further than that. I mean, that might be totally useless and totally impractical. It might be great, so somebody has something to contribute and tell me, oh gosh, don't do that, or yes, we need that basis necessarily, let me know. Thank you very much.
More questions?
So I think so, yeah.